Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm the man at the controls, Al Warren. Co-hosting today, we've got Eric Shapiro, the doctor.
How you doing, Al?
I'm delicious.
Good to be here. Oh, excellent. Oh, just the way I like you.
Yeah. And we've got a newbie that we're breaking in hard. David North Martino.
Hey, Al. Hey, Eric.
Yeah. How you doing, David? Yeah.
Hey.
Now you know why he has to drink.
Yes.
Right. It's a recent thing.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
I'm going to pull one right now.
Yeah, that would be a good time.
He sits he sits with his pussy and drinks.
Right. Fair enough.
He's a cat aficionado, and he's got a he's a catty dog, like or a catty daddy, whatever you call them.
Oh, I couldn't have imagined you meaning anything else.
Yeah. That's me.
My cat is coming to see me as we're talking about this. You called him.
Excellent. Okay.
I love it. Love good cats. Now, today we are talking to, speaking of horror, we're talking, Martino, you're a horror author, so we've got another one here.
Absolutely.
Written a ton of books. Greg F. Gaffuni, thank you for being here.
It's Gaffune.
Greg F. Gaffune, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
We'll see if you say that at the end.
No.
Well, let's see.
Yeah, well. So now you've got a couple of new books out, but before we get into that, let's go back to where it all started. Like, talk about how did you get into writing and writing horror? Like, was this something you did from a kid, or is this something that just came along lately, or where did it come from?
It was a little bit of both, actually. I come from a family of two. My parents were both teachers, so I was introduced very early on to books and reading. I could read before I went to school, and writing was always something that just kind of came to me. It was just something I always did, even before I could write. I have an older sister, and I used to dictate things to her, and she would write them down. And she was thrilled when I learned how to write, trust me. It just was sort of a natural thing for me to get things out of me to write. As for horror, I never really started off to be a horror writer. I still don't really consider myself a horror writer. I just consider myself a writer. I mostly work in horror and crime, sometimes the communities get upset when you say that because you're denigrating. I don't mean it like that. It's just, I just kind of write what I write, and it's whatever category people want to put it into. That's fine.
It's generally pretty dark, though, isn't it? When you say it's consistent across your novels, whether it's crime
I mean, when I do crime, I'm doing more of the Jim Thompson stuff, not, you know, cozy mysteries. So,
it's pretty
dark stuff. But it's in terms of how I get into it, it just sort of was something that I always wanted to do. And I did it, you know, as an amateur for growing up. And then my life kind of went in a different direction. And I got involved in some other things. And I had to kind of find my way back, which I did. In my early 30s, and decided to give it a real shot professionally. And, you know, I was married at the time, and I was coming off of a company that I had owned and had done fairly well. So I said to my wife, you know, look, if I don't try this now, I'm never gonna. And so she said she was working her way up the corporate ladder at the time. And she said, well, you know, that was 5 years. So. And I said, well, it sounds fair. So she gave me 5 years, and she said, if after 5 years you haven't done anything, you got to go get a job and, you know, pursue it part-time. And I said, fine. And 4.5 years in, I sold my novel, my first novel.
And that was The Bleeding Season.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which really kind of put me on the map. So I just made it. I just went under the wire.
Oh, wow. And what I really love about Greg's fiction, guys, is I haven't read so much of the crime stuff, but on the end of the darker fiction, what some people call horror, is it registers to me more as surrealism. It's like it's kind of like a nightmare state, like a silent scream. And I remember the first book of yours I read was I think it was The Rain Dancers. Which is a novella, and I remember what really made an impression on me was that, and this is the same for all your books, I think I've read like 8 or 10 of them now. There's a saturated emotion from the first second to the last. Like, and that's when I said, I'm like, okay, I'm really in the presence of a major leaguer. Like from beginning to end, it's incredibly immersive on the level of atmosphere and feeling, and it never lets up, and you've got it under control the entire time. And, of course, that's an intuitive call. Like, not every reader is going to hear it or pick up what you're putting down, but I think it's, potent in a way where that's why you've gotten on the map, and it's, so I was curious to hear about that, you know, sort of being emotionally available to your writing and how you bring those feelings across.
Well, there's kind of a two, as you know this already, but there's kind of two parts to everything that I write. There's the surface story, which I try to make, you know, entertaining, and I try to make it self-contained so that if the reader just wants to experience that, great, you know, and hopefully it works for them. But then there's also a subtext. There's another story going on underneath, and if they want to get in there, they can get in there. And that's where a lot of the real emotion comes from, I guess, for me. It's just, I think Robert Dunbar, who wrote The Pines, who's a great writer, a good friend, he coined a term called what do you call it? Acting method. Method writing.
Yeah. A method writing.
Like method acting. And when he said it, it really hit me because I thought, yeah, that's what I do. I didn't really realize that's what I did, but that's what I do. So
are you
kind of drawing from your own things?
It's interesting because I think you're often in the third person, aren't you? Because it always feels like the first person. Because I always emotionally pick it up like it is the first person, whether you're in first or third. And I guess that goes hand in hand with what you're saying. It's like a method. You're tapped in at that angle. It's a method sort of process.
Yeah, it goes back and forth. I mean, it depends on what the book calls for. I mean, certain things just lend themselves better to first person. Certain things lend themselves better to third. It just, you know, and there's times when it goes, I mean, The Bleeding Season is a good example. When I first wrote that, it was third person. I got about a quarter of the way through it. I said, no, this has to be first person.
God. Yeah. It's funny. Cause I sometimes have trouble remembering when I think back on your books, which is not in any way a negative comment. It's just because either way, it's so on the axis of that emotional expression.
Right. Well, yeah. I think if you don't hit that, if you're not hitting that, then it's all surface stuff, which, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's more of a purge, you know?
Yeah. It's yeah. Well said.
Trying to get stuff out. I'm trying to get things the hell out of me, and that's the best way to do it.
Yeah. I remember, your novella Midnight Gods, which is more recent, which is more, a commentary on, you know, the Trump years and in terms of, everybody being afraid and tribalism and partisanship. And, it's a story where there's a virus, or in other words, fear is functioning as a virus, like fear is a contagion in a community. And then it's implied that it goes beyond that community. I remember when I first read it, I felt like I was, I think this is the word you ultimately used, but it was the feeling I had for sure. Like I was being smothered. I was like, oh my God, he's getting to like a panic attack level of emotional potency. It's like I'm having ice poured all over me. And it's just the fact that you, as an artist can tap that always astonishes me. That is, and I'm curious if you don't
mind speaking to... Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Oh, definitely, yeah. If you don't mind speaking to, like, personally, and yeah, I don't want to overstep any boundaries, but is there a certain level of anguish or neurosis or something that that comes from that you're tapping into? Or, like are you... when you're
you
in
know,
that method...
I'm sure there is.
Yeah.
I'm sure there is. There has to be.
When you're in that method process, do you feel tormented? Is it difficult?
Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, without... You know, it's hard to talk about sometimes because you sound, you don't want to sound... you know, pretentious, but you know, but it is torturous for me. I'm definitely in the Dorothy Parker camp. I hate writing. I love having written.
Okay.
You know, the process itself is not, I always envy people when they say, it's so much fun to write. And I wrote this story and it was so much fun. I think, wow, that must be awesome. That must be so cool. For me, I feel like I'm being pummeled with a bat through the whole thing. When it's done, I feel a sense of relief and I hopefully like what I end up with.
Yeah.
But it's very draining.
How many novels are in the body of work now? And you include novellas in that. Like how many are there now?
A little over 20.
Are there any, because in my exposure to you, so I probably read half of them or just shy of half. And I've always thought they're dependably great. I mean, I think your ground game is fantastic. So are there any that you don't like or that you feel soft about?
You know, honestly, no. There's some I like better than others. There was one that I wrote called Night Work, which was actually the first novel I ever wrote. It wasn't the first published novel, but it was the first novel I ever wrote. That was initially published by a small house when I was starting out, and they made me do some, well, they didn't make me, but I kind of made some changes to it that I didn't really like to kind of fit their deal. And I was kind of disappointed in that, but I got a chance, you know, a few years later, with Down and Out Books. They're primarily my crime, publisher. They reissued it as an anniversary, kind of like what Journal Stone did with Bleeding Season. Allowed me to kind of do a preferred authors edition. So I was able to kind of get that. So I can say now, no, but I think the other reason that I can say no is that I didn't start out that early. I mean, I didn't become a published, right? I was in my mid to late 30s when I finally hit. So, there was a long period of time there. There was a long learning curve. There was a lot of many years of rejection and failure, which I think made me better and made me. It's one of the things that I think is unfortunate about the self-publishing craze today is that I think if you've established in other ways and then you do it, I think it's fine. But to not go through that, I think it's detrimental. You know, failure is good. Failure makes you stronger. Failure is what makes you better. It's what challenges you. And it can bury you if you let it. But, and, you know, there were times it came close to burying me. I went through almost 5 straight years of it.
Go
ahead. How do you know that? So for you personally, I have the similar experience as you do. Writing, and I had the same experience about getting published finally and then doing some of my own, but and the emotional drain and the dislike, kind of the struggle to get through it and then the relief when it's done. But with all of that, where do you get the confidence to say, yeah, this is ready and this is, I want to publish this, or do you know what I'm saying?
You know,
to send a story in.
You know, one of my mentors gave me the best piece of advice, which was if you're going to do this, be fearless. If you can't be fearless, get out of the game. And it's okay to be afraid. That doesn't mean you can't be afraid and you can't be uncertain. It's not about being arrogant. But, you know, and I certainly am not comparing the two. But it's like, you know, my dad was a World War II combat veteran. I said to him once when I was a little boy, weren't you afraid? And he said, well, yeah, anybody in their right mind was, you're terrified. But you won anyway.
Wow, yeah.
You know, and that always stuck with me. And when this guy, this mentor of mine said that to me, it reminded me of that, you know, conceptually. Again, I'm not comparing the two by any means. But but the idea that if you wait around to be sure, you know, and but you're totally confident in everything you do, you're never going to do anything, number one. And number two, you know who's totally confident 100% of the time and thinks that they're geniuses? People that aren't. So, yeah, you know, the idea of being uncertain and of being, that's part of the process, man. That's part of being, that there's nothing wrong with that. I think you're better off having, they should be uncertain.
But how do you choose these emotional, because you're talking about very emotional points in your books, like they really come out. So how do you choose what you're going to share with the world?
You know, I think I'd be lying to you if I said I do. I just do it. Whatever needs to come out, that's what I put down. Because I always, it's like when I mentor people now, I say, look, you can always edit. You can always take something out. You know what I mean? But don't ever be in a position where you didn't put enough in. So, you know, like Hemingway, you'll bleed all over the page. You can clean it up. You can mop up some of that if you don't want to use it later. So I tend to just put it all out there and I try to be as fearless as possible. And sure, I go through a process with every, it's so common now that even I see it coming. It's kind of ridiculous, but I still go through it. Every book I write, every single one, without fail, I hit a point where I do the whole, you know, George C. Scott used to do the same thing on every film. I just get blinding drunk and go into a rage and this book sucks. I suck. You know, everything I do sucks. Why am I wasting my time with this? This is terrible. You know,
that's when I block Greg on my phone when that happens.
Yeah, yeah.
I take
Eric knows. Yeah.
The friendship. Yeah.
Eric knows. When I hit that, yeah. Just,
yeah. I'll catch up with you later.
Yeah, I'll see you. I'll see you in a couple of days. But yeah, but then once, you know, I do that, I've just sort of incorporated it as part of my process, you know, that there's going to be that doubt. There's going to be those things. Did I pick the right things? Am I, you know, is this too far? And, you know, there's times when and I'm sure you guys can relate to this. There's times when you're writing something that you're not, you know, it takes a certain type of personality to live with a writer because you're not always pleasant when you're writing.
Oh,
something,
you said you know? It. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah.
You don't mean it. You don't, it's not directed at anybody. It's just, you're going through this thing trying to do exactly what you just added. Where do I go with it? What do I, you know, what do I put in? What do I don't, what do I allow myself to feel with this? What do I pull back from? And it's, so I think it's, but I think those are all good things. I mean, that's art, man. That's a, you know,
it's a journey.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't think it should be easy necessarily. I think if you're just kind of sitting back and flicking them out there, you know what I mean? And it doesn't mean they're bad necessarily, but I mean, I don't really see the point of that myself. That's just me.
Yeah. It's interesting you brought up George C. Scott, because it's one thing I was telling the guys before we all got on is that you're an atypical writer. I think this is something that you and I related on when we found each other on the scene. Like, you're not the guy at a cafe with glasses, like, you know, Nebuchadnezzar, no. You know, tapping out, you know, you and I are like a pair of brutes. I'm like, you're a tougher guy. And like, it's interesting, George C. Scott, because he was tough as nails, but he was also, and this applies to you too, he's very sensitive. He was a beautiful person. I mean, I just watched the Exorcist 3 in the last couple months, and it was like just the blend. I mean, he's so tough and he commands total authority at the same time. A totally, you know, emotionally present and sensitive.
Yeah.
Just you know, there's a sweetness to him that's undeniable. And I was wondering, on that note, an interesting question is, like, do you generally find yourself mixing in with other writers? Is it more, you know, obviously it depends on the writer, but are writers the sort of crowd you rush toward, or do you sort of hang at the back of the class?
I hang towards the back of the class. I'm more that guy.
Yeah.
I'm not necessarily repelled by other writers, although there are a few. But I'm not big on the whole group dynamic. I never have been. I don't like the whole sort of cliquey kind of, I tend to have small circles, in both as a writer and as a human being. I'm not big on, I don't join organizations. I'm not an awards guy. I don't care about any of that stuff. People that do got knock yourself out. It's whatever. I have my own thoughts on, you know, this, Eric. I don't like competition in the art. I don't think that's what it should be about.
Yeah, it's funny. I agree with you. The only area in which I disagree is I think that I should win. That's all.
Yeah. Well, if they're going to get him out, I guess.
That's the only angle I come in on. It's just this one.
I think, and I think that's why some people have been baffled by me in this, particularly in the horror genre, is that it's sometimes taken as I'm being superior or it's nothing. Like, they need to believe me when I say I really don't care.
Yeah, you're just indifferent. I don't care. You're neutral.
I'm totally indifferent. I don't need an award to tell me that I'm a good writer. It doesn't matter to me. The only awards I've ever gotten that really meant something to me was I've got a couple of Reader's Choice awards that I got, a couple of plaques.
Oh, nice.
That I have. Those mean a lot to me because those came directly from readers.
Yeah.
You know, I don't need, I just don't need my peers to tell me how wonderful I am all the time. I don't need that. And I don't mean that I'm not trying to be a jerk. It's just, it's no interest to me. I like it when people like what I do and we have common respect for each other, and that's great. And that's, and like I say, if that's your bag, great. Yeah. Knock yourself out. It's just
Terrible bag. I agree. I totally.
I was going to ask you, Al.
I hate groups. I hate. because you have to form yourself to fit the group in the way that it's supposed to be. And in order for you to win anything, you have to follow the rules, so to speak. And
if you don't, you're accused of sour grapes. There's a built-in defense mechanism with that crowd where, if you're critical, it's because, it's because sour grapes. Trust me. Yeah. Trust me. Yeah. I am not jealous.
I agree with all of that. I'm just not into it. Plus, a lot of times these groups make you feel bad about yourself, in my experience. They're never positive for me.
See, part of the problem, I liken it. It's not as bad. Because, listen, there's a lot of really good people in these groups and a lot of really good writers.
Yeah.
Let's not pretend that there isn't, because there are, and very good people too. But I think there's something common in my experience, my life experience, with groups that runs kind of parallel to mobs. And mobs often start off. I don't mean the mob. Like, we can talk about that too if you want. But
we'll get there in a sec.
We'll get there. Great. but they generally start off very well intentioned, but they're kind of doomed to become something besides that. And so for me, I just look at that and my biggest problem with it is I just don't see what that has to do with what I do.
Right.
If somebody else does, awesome. If you do, and plenty of people do, and that's great. I really don't have anything against people that want to do that. It's just not my thing. I wish I got the same amount of respect for that they demand that I give them.
Right. Interesting. It exists in every field. It's like whether you're a dentist or an insurance salesman, there's a club where you get together and you mix and you mingle and you give awards. And I think it's part of the pro-social nature of our species, and it's fine. But like you said, it's not, is the word endemic? It's not part and parcel of the trade. It has nothing to do with it.
Well, yeah. And the other problem with it is, Eric, is that it becomes very insular in the sense that it becomes this little bubble where people start to believe that if you're not a part of that, you're somehow not really there. You're not really in the
world out there, kid.
You know? Yeah. Are you kidding me? It's like there's an entire, industry out there that's got nothing to do with what you're talking about.
Exactly.
So for me, it's just not about that. I'm here to do my work, get my books out, and that's it. I'm here to write what I write. You know, people can throw whatever they want at me. I'm an artist. I create art, and I get on with my life.
That being said, is it important to get good feedback from other writers for you? Like, not in a group set, but let's say some writer you like yourself, you might not know them, and if they turn around and do a review on your book or give you a 4-star or whatever they do, does that mean something?
I'm always pleased and flattered when somebody likes what I do, but I learned a long time ago to not take reviews and things like that. Don't take the good ones. Don't take those too seriously. And don't take the bad ones too seriously either. Just, take them for what they are and move on. I mean, there are writers that I respect and who, if they read something of mine, maybe ahead of publication or something, and they offer some, sure, absolutely. There's people like that. It's not like I'm totally, off on my own somewhere, but I mean, there's certainly other writers that I respect and that there's plenty of them. There are some that I've given work to, and they've made it better. I'm certainly open to, I've worked with some great editors. I mean, I'm always open to, like I've said before, I don't care if it's the mailman. If you've got a good idea, I'll use it. I mean, it's, the idea is to make the work better. If you can make it better, I'll make it better. And there's other writers, but I mean, I don't have the, and I don't necessarily, I think if you're starting out, it's probably, there's pros and cons to the whole sort of group dynamic with that. I never did a lot of that. I did a lot more one-on-one. I was fortunate enough to have a couple of guys that were ahead of me in the business that saw something in me and kind of took me under their wing and, guided me and gave me some excellent advice. And that was good for me. For other people, maybe a bigger group dynamic works for them. If it does, God love you. Go do that. But I've never really, that's never really interested me, and it's never really, I don't feel I've really required it.
New books, Blue Hell. Let's talk about the story. Where does a story like this come from for you? Like, how does it get into Greg's head? Are you sleeping one night, or you see someone in a bookstore? Like, where does the characters come from and the storyline come from?
It's interesting. Usually for me, it's the characters first. The characters come to me, and then if I listen to them, their stories.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Are kind of born out of them. And that's where I get, you know, the plot comes from the character. But if you were to ask me where, you know, and I've been asked, anybody who's a writer that's been a writer for more than 10 minutes, you know, has answered the question, where do you get your ideas, you know, about a million times. And the honest answer is, I have no idea. I have no idea where they come from. I know that they come, and I know that they probably come from within me somewhere, but I don't really question it. I know the pieces that come from me that are definitely coming from me. For me, it's initially more like a puzzle. I very rarely have an idea or a concept. I think I've done it twice in my entire career, 20 plus years, that I ever had an idea and sat down and started writing it. Things kind of nest in my mind for long, long periods of time, like usually several years.
But when you say you listen to your characters, what kind of relationship do you have with your players?
Depends on who they are. Depends on what I'm doing. It can be a little bit of everything. It can be friendly. It can be unfriendly. It can be, you know, tough. You know, a little somewhere, a little easier. It just depends on what you're doing. Like Blue Hell, for example, is an interesting piece because I had a short story that I'd written called Malevolent Night, and it was published years ago, and it's been published in, I don't know, like 3 or 4 anthologies. But I always thought there was more to it. Like, I always thought there was more to that story that I, you know, there was something, it was a decent story. I liked it, but I felt like there was something more there. And so I wrote it again, and I wrote it up to a certain point. And then I kind of had an idea of like an end piece, but I didn't have anything in the middle. And it really stumped me for probably close to a year. And then I would, you know, put it aside, go back to it, put it aside. And I couldn't seem to get that piece. And it's one of the few times I've ever collaborated, because I wrote the book with Sandy DeLuca, who's a dear friend and an old friend of mine. I've known her since the 80s. She's a very accomplished artist and author herself. And I sent it to her and I just said, look, take a look at this. Is there anything here? You know, what do you think? And she read it and she said, yeah, there's definitely something here. She said, but you're missing the, I said, yeah, there's nothing in the middle here. There's nothing to tie it all together. And she said, well, you know what? I have a piece. She had these characters and this piece of story that she had removed from a novel that she had written that didn't really fit in that novel. So she pulled it out and left it aside. And it was just kind of laying around. She said, let me play around with it and see what I can do with it. And she kind of plugged it in and then sent it back to me. And it was perfect. It was like, God, there it is. There's the bridge. So we edited it and sort of, you know, cleaned it up and, you know, brought it all together, tied up all the loose ends, and it came together perfectly. And that was kind of a unique situation because I've never done that before. And it was kind of two people just kind of getting in sync with it, you know? So sometimes it comes together like that. Other times it just, like I say, the things just sit in my head for a long, long time. And then when it feels like it's ready to write, I write it. And I just go with it. I don't outline. I take notes. I have notebooks. Like, I drive my wife crazy. I have notebooks all over the house. So I'm always scribbling. Wait a minute, I'll scribble something down so I don't forget. But I don't really outline very – I do more notes. It's mostly continuity stuff because I don't like to – I like to know where I'm going, but I don't want to be too rigid either. You know, I want to be able to still go in different directions that I wasn't anticipating. And again, to go back to listening to the characters, sometimes the characters want to take you in a certain direction. Sometimes you want to ignore that and be disciplined, and other times you need to listen to them. You need to go in that direction. It just depends on, you know, it's a kind of a piece by piece thing. I don't have like a blanket kind of way of doing it, I guess.
Right. Right. So when you say method writing, so it's actually like being in the situation, being in the characters and going right through with it. But how do you fit your subtext into it? Like, how do you get your characters to follow what you want them to do? Or as in the subtext, not necessarily as the main story.
I think with the subtext, that's where the emotion is. And that's where, not that there's none in the surface athletes on there too, but that's really where you have to deeply, deeply draw from yourself. And where it really does become method, where you have to draw from your own experiences and try to find parallel things that can, or in some cases, things that are very, very close. And you try to, you know, you just try to draw from them. And it's a balancing act, because you don't want the subtext to ruin the surface either, you know? So you have to be careful. You have to be balanced. You have to have, they both have to exist, kind of coexist without, you know, screwing up the other one. You know, they have to kind of maintain on their own. But I think for me, it's just a matter of, that's where I start to pull out the real deep stuff out of me. The pain that I'm exploring, or whatever it is that I'm exploring, that's where I put it. And if you do it in a way that complements the surface, you know, in other words, you don't want to disrupt it, that works for me.
Did you find that Sandy fit in well on the emotional side of things? Like, you had an intuitive connection?
We kind of have for a long time. We're like really good friends.
Oh, nice.
I mean, I think to a degree, she was really the perfect person to approach with it, because Sandy is a very, very skilled with surreal fiction. She's very, very good.
Oh, wow.
And that's kind of her thing. And Blue Hell is a very surreal, I mean, kind of David Lynch-esque kind of piece, where there's essentially three stories that are unfolding and you don't know how they're connected until the end. Mm. But her sensibilities as a writer were perfect for that piece.
And it sounds to me, the way you described it, she held up the middle story. So it was somewhat of a compartmentalized approach, where you weren't under that pressure to sort of pass it back and forth and blend your voices sentence by sentence, or am I misunderstanding that?
Well, yeah, generally you're right. I mean, there was a point where we had to do that so that it had that flow.
Yeah.
You know, but it was a little bit, I know what you mean. It was a little bit later in the process where we could just sort of find that singular, you know, thing, and then just sort of edit it together so that it, you know, it's like, you know, it's like magic. There's a way you're doing it, but it looks like it's seamless. It's not, but it looks that way.
Right, right. So. Yeah. But it always sounded to me, because I've only co-written prose as a journalist with my wife. I've done it like 10 times where we just pass it back and forth, but there's a deep right trust and mutual respect, and it's pretty painless. But the idea of sitting in a room with a co-writer, especially with prose, I mean, I've done it a lot with screenplays, but which are kind of a lighter form in terms of the amount of verbiage.
Right.
But the idea of being right in a room and brainstorming and being like, all right, do we set this in a basement or do we set it in the hallway? And it's like every single thing. Like, I think I would lose my mind.
Well, it's funny, you know, Ron, if you guys know Ronald Nalfi, who's a great writer, actually yeah, really good guy, good friend of mine. And we've been sort of knocking around a novel back and forth for almost 2 years now. And we sort of work on it when we have time, which is not a lot. And you know, it's hard. It's hard. I think we have a similar kind of style, and I have a great deal of respect for Ron. I know he respects me, and we've found a thing that works, but it's difficult. It's a much harder process to sort of go back and forth like that and find your footing,
yeah,
and make sure you're going to go in the right direction and do the right things. Blue Hell worked out a little bit better because it was a shorter piece, and it was also even though it seems complex on the surface, once you get to the heart of it, you realize that it's a little bit more, it's more sort of straightforward than you thought it was. And so it was a little bit easier to mesh the two together, you know, as opposed to what you're saying, where you had to do a whole lot of brainstorming and passing back and forth. She understood what the concept was and basically fit her work to fill the hole that was missing in it. And without her, Blue Hell would have never been both. It would have never even existed without her. So I'm grateful to her.
What you just said was key in terms of her contribution. Because also the other thing that could happen, I've seen this a lot as a ghostwriter, because it's collaboration. So I've had to work with umpteenth people. But when it's under my own name and you're collaborating, you can make it functional. You can hammer it out. You can make it work. You can blend it all together. But then there's the question of like what you're saying with Sandy or Ron, where they actually, and I'm getting this implication from what you said about Ron, they actually enhance you and you enhance them. And that's an ideal collaboration. Yeah. As opposed to like, there's nightmarish collaborations where you feel like you're carrying the other person on their back, or maybe you're hindering what they prefer to do, you know? So,
right. Well, to be honest too, I've not done a lot of collaborations because what I do is very precise.
Yeah.
And it's very personal.
Yeah.
And so it's often very difficult to do that with somebody else.
Oh, you're not kidding.
And stay true to that. You know,
it's almost private on some level. It's like you suddenly have to like talk it out with some douchebag. It's like, oh no. Yeah.
I mean, it's not something I do with a lot of people. I mean, you and I have collaborated on some stuff, some screenplay stuff and stuff, and that we were, I think we work very well together.
Oh, I agree. We always have a blast. I mean, I think it's because we're both operating with intuition and it's like a feeling. We both are just like looking at it through our third eye. It's like, oh, God, I see what you're doing here. What if it was like this?
Right.
It's not like we have to roll up our sleeves and discuss every choice for 2 hours, which really came from it. Yeah.
Well, but also too, like you say, we're also dealing in a different area. So a novel, I think we could do a novel together, but I think it's a lot more complicated.
Yeah, it's more complicated. And then it becomes a question of like, there's always that question, which is all well and good because we've done novels respectively. It's like, it would have to be just the right material and premise and structure where not only do we complement each other, but we also lift each other up. Yeah.
Right. And that's not always easy to find, Eric. You know what I mean?
That's, oh, no question.
In fact,
about it.
In fact, it's actually very hard to find. You know?
Yeah. I agree. I agree. It's an intuitive, there has to be an intuitive bond. And I think trust is such a big part of it, too.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's
especially
like
with Eric.
Yeah.
So you gotta watch him. Yeah, it's true.
He'll be
publishing it beforehand with his name on it.
I just wrote the intro to one of Al's books and I had to just not move past page 3 because I wanted to rewrite the whole thing. I'll do it his way, I guess. Yeah.
Well, you were kind enough to write that Journal Stone did a 15-year anniversary edition of The Bleeding Season.
Yeah,
in 2018. And speaking of, since these names came up, Ron wrote was kind enough to write the introduction to that one, and you were kind enough to write the afterword.
Yeah, which was awesome. And that book is a full blown classic. I mean, it's Spellbinding.
So it was
my pleasure. And Al, also, let there be no mistake, it was my honor too with you as well.
That's why he called me insane.
Yeah.
I mean, in a bad way.
Exactly. It's the highest form of compliment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, okay, let's move to your God Machine. One thing I noticed about the God Machine, okay, so it's in the hotel room and all that, and the prostitute takes her own life. Do you make the actual scene a character in itself?
I think to a degree that's fair, yeah, I think so. I mean, that God Machine was kind of a marriage of two concepts. There was God Machine was actually a real thing. There was a guy, John Murray Spear, who in the 1850s was a, depending upon who you asked, was either a charlatan or a prophet. He was from Massachusetts. I believe they were doing it in Lynn. It was a big time for spiritualism and all that. He supposedly claimed that these angels came to him and told him how to build this machine. From metal and wood, and if he stuck to the blueprint, the machine would come to life and it would literally summon God. And I always thought that concept was, I remember reading about it, you know, a few years back, and I just thought, Jesus, that's really good stuff. There's some way I could use that. And I never really, you know, had anything that I could come up with. And then I had another concept where I wanted to write a story about loss and an anti-war thing too. I had seen an interview with a couple who had their only child, their son, had just been shipped back in a box from Iraq. And these people were just so devastated. There was this, of course, but I mean, and I remember the mother was, I've never seen anyone that broken, just so visibly just destroyed. And the father was the same, but there was something with him too, that there was something else. There was this rage in him, and it wasn't anger. I mean, I'm talking rage. And I remember there was someone that was talking to him. I don't know if it was a reporter or someone that was presenting them with whatever the hell it was, but essentially they kept saying the standard lines of, well, thank you for your son's service. And every time they would say stuff like that, this guy would kind of twitch. And I thought, if they don't stop this guy's going to, he's going to choke this guy, you know? And it was just heartbreaking. And I thought, they ended it and they went right back and then they went on to some other story. And I thought, Jesus, we're at a point where essentially children, these are 18, 19, 20 year old kids, are coming home in boxes, or they're coming home without their legs. They're coming home without their arms. They're coming home with their minds. They're completely just broken. That's if they're lucky, they're still alive. I mean, we're dropping these kids into these meat grinders and yet we're able, somehow we've gotten to a point as a society where we can just kind of say, oh boy, that's too bad. Anyway, what's for dinner?
Yeah.
That's just okay with us. Somehow we're not demanding that this needs to stop, this sort of wholesale slaughter of our children. And that I wanted to do something with that. And so that's where, with God Machine, the one story, the surface story, is about a cop who loses his daughter, his only child, he and his wife, to a roadside bomb in Iraq. And he, as a result, he becomes an alcoholic, loses his career as a policeman, and ends up as the security, basically a more or less a security guard in a less than five star, let's say, Cape Cod hotel. And, this young woman who's a prostitute, who's clearly in trouble and needs somewhere to stay. And he sort of takes pity on her and sees not so much his daughter, but his daughter would have been that age. And he sees this sort of, maybe I can help. I couldn't help my daughter, maybe I can help her. And when she commits suicide, and she does so in an extremely violent and grisly way, and it's very ritualistic and things written on the wall in blood, and it's way, just insane. And he sort of embarks on this journey to find out what happened and why she did this, and to make sense of her death, because he can never make sense. He can never reconcile his daughter's death. And it's really about his pain and his wife's pain. It's about loss. It's about all of those things. But then there's this underlying thing. And the deeper he goes into trying to find out what happened to this prostitute, he gets into some very dark areas and against some very dark people, into some very, very bad, dark, evil things. And I don't want to give too much of the book away, but the God Machine concept figures into that later on. But it's that was a marriage of both of those things.
Did you have struggle with that yourself, like the occult and that sort of thing? Is that sort of something that you've had personal experience with? That's why it's there.
I will say this: I'm a Christian. I'm Catholic. I'm Italian. It's the law. I'm not practicing. I haven't been several years. I have never been into the occult, with quotations.
Yeah.
I have been around it. I have seen what it can do to people. So to a degree, yes. And I've known loss. And so this was a way to kind of hopefully purge some of those things. But yeah, I think there's a there's a, you know, it depends on what you're talking about. There's a kind of casual, you know, like it's like some of the Satanism that's around now. It's kind of like, okay, I guess you could call it that. But there's a difference between that, and there are some very, very dark forces in this world. If you don't think there are, you just need to get out of the house more. And you can label them however you like, but I think, you know, dealing with that kind of thing is a whole different, it's a whole different level. Whatever you want to assign it to, you know, evil absolutely exists. Now, however you want to define that, however you want to, whatever box you want to put that into, or category or heading you want to give it, feel free. But yeah, it's something that I think I've seen to a degree. I don't want to really get into a whole lot of stuff, but there's some things that I have seen. Sure. Yeah. And I mean, I think it's the short answer is yes.
Okay. So with this particular book, what do you think you wanted people to get out of it? Was it the connection with loss?
I hope so. I mean, if first of all, I hope it's entertaining. I hope people like it. I hope they enjoy it. That's the number one thing. Because I think if you don't have that part of it, you're never, you know, people aren't going to stick around long enough to get, if there's some other deeper point, you know, if they're not going to be there long enough to get it if you don't have them with that. So, but yeah, I hope so. I mean, you know, I think you always hope for that. You know, I mean, you never really know when that's going to hit. I mean, I remember I wrote a book called Living in the Dead a few years back. And, you know, it was one of the characters was a Vietnam vet who was badly damaged mentally from that. And I based some of that. My dad had some issues from his combat experiences, and I based it, him, you know, some of his things on that. And I got this letter about a year after the book came out from a Vietnam vet who said that that the book really helped him. And that character really kind of spoke to him, and he saw himself in this character, and it really helped him with some of the things he was struggling with. And I mean, that to me, like at that point, I can retire, you know, I mean, yeah. You know, okay, well then, you know, I don't know how you top that, but that was so moving to think that something that I did could have that kind of a profound effect on somebody. So you hope that it does. If this helps somebody that's experienced loss, if it helps them in some way, great. I hope so. But you know, you can't ever really, you never know, but you hope, I certainly would hope so.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So yourself, let's talk about, now if people want to get a hold of you, do you have your own website?
You know, I do have one. I don't know what. It's not really bad. I don't know what the hell the address is. I don't do it. So okay. It's out there. Some WordPress. I don't know. I need to get one. I'm more like I'm on social media. People can find me on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm on the hell's the other one? Instagram. I just went on there. I've tried. I had to start my third Instagram account because the first two.
I'm glad to finally stuck.
Jesus, yeah. So that was a pain, but I'm on social media. I'm available on my email is gfgauthor@verizon.net. I'm available that way.
Well, we'll make sure it's all up there. We'll figure it out. We'll find you, and we'll put it up on our website so people can find you easier.
We also have giveaways.
Yeah, I was going to say we have some giveaways now. I guess your publishers, two different ones, have agreed. I guess the first three emails I get will get the you know what? We'll take in the first eight emails we get with your name and address. We will send you a copy of one of the two new books, either The God Machine or Blue Hell. So that's a pleasure. I'm sure that'll go real fast.
Yeah, and I want to thank Crossroad and Macabre Inc., which is their paperback edition or division, for those, and also General Stone for the Blue Hell copies, a couple of great publishers I've worked with for a long time. And thank you to them.
How's the COVID? Does it affect your writing?
You know, it really hasn't altered. I mean, I kind of miss going out. I miss going to bars because, you know, I tend to drink now and then. Yeah. I miss that. But luckily I have one in my house. But I don't. Yeah, I mean, not really. I you know, it's kind of an I have an office in my home. So, it hasn't really altered a hell of a lot. My wife has been working from home for a long time. And that's been kind of nice to have her home. Well, but no, not really. I mean, other than it affects, you know, being able to. I miss people.
Yeah, I some just people, thought because you're pretty you're in touch with emotions and really putting them in your book. So I was just wondering when it's really dark like that, you know, like the last year with all the stuff going on, if it would make you write even darker or get more emotional.
You know, probably I. Yes and no. I wrote mostly through that last year. I wrote a novel called The Gypsy Moths. It's going to be, I'm actually just waiting on the contract. It's it'll be out in December. And that's a little both. It's a very dark piece, but it's also a very hopeful piece. I would say during that, this last sort of era, starting with Midnight Gods, as Eric talked about. I think it's definitely, I've tried not to make it all about that, but it's to say that it would hasn't influenced it in some ways would be silly. Yeah. I mean, sure. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's been a great hour. We appreciate you taking the time and
oh, my pleasure.
And talking to us. Our guest has been author Greg F. Gaffoon. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, Greg. It was good talking to you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
You're lying to me. I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.